Is Dobbs a political disaster? Will there be abortion clinics on federal lands? And what to make of the football coach prayer decision? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook and the Sage of Authenticity Woods, Jim Garrity. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsor this episode is NetChoice. More about them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So Jim Garrity, epic decision on Friday. We talked about it on Friday's episode. Haven't heard from you on it yet. So let's jump in. We've had a couple days to absorb it. We've had some early polling, and the early polling suggests the public is on Roe is where it was before this decision, which is that it likes Roe and it opposes the overturning of Roe. What do you make of that?
So I had three reactions, all guaranteed to tick off somebody. The first was, unsurprisingly, that this was a massive, almost near miraculous triumph for the pro-life movement. If you believe that abortion stops a beating heart, if you believe that abortion does amount to the ending of a human life, if, you know, at some point in that pregnancy, then this is a necessary step and a huge triumph. And when you think about how everybody felt the day we learned that Justice Scalia had passed away, to end up at this point in June 2022 is just mind-boggling. The other was kind of, you know, I don't say chortling, but maybe just marveling at the irony that a major factor in things playing out the way they did was Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. As I noted in the corner back in 2013, after he'd been reelected and Democrats controlled Congress, former President Barack Obama had lunch with Justice Ginsburg and not so subtly hinted, he never came out and said, you should retire. But he basically said, you know, well, we probably aren't going to be able to have control of the Senate after next midterm. Boy, how are you feeling at 80 years old? And, you know, I know you survived cancer twice. And, you know, don't choke on that chicken bone. You know, all these different signals that, look, if you don't leave soon, we may not be able to replace you with a like-minded one. And there's no, you know, obviously, Ginsburg either did not take the hint, or, and there's some speculation, she probably didn't appreciate that. But she obviously, you know, chose to stay on. Lo and behold, Donald Trump defeated Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election.
One of my favorite pieces that's been resurfaced in this period here was a piece for Slate, I believe, saying how sexist it was to pressure Ruth Bader Ginsburg to retire on a rational political schedule.
And I think that some progressives already have changed their opinion of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They still admire her. They still, you know, agree with all of her decisions, et cetera. But this is an enormously consequential decision to not retire when she had the opportunity and when a like-minded justice would have replaced her. And just counting on the fact that she would live through the Trump administration, and she did not, and being replaced with Justice Barrett. Like, that's a huge factor in all this, because just a couple of people were like, oh, you know, it was 6-3. Well, yeah, but here's the thing. We all read, or at least we had, you know, we're familiar with Chief Justice Roberts' concurrence, but he certainly seemed much less enthusiastic for this. And in a 4-4 split, it's really hard to imagine Roberts signing on to be that justice. And to
I wouldn't have done it.
Yeah, he would have found some narrowly tailored way that kind of sort of puts more restrictions on abortion, but kicks the bigger question down the can down the road. And that's, you know, that's just the kind of justice he is. And so, that, you know, this turned out 6-3 because of Ginsburg passing away and Barrett being on the court. So you look at that and that's marveling. And then the last reaction I had, which I kind of laid out in yesterday's Morning Jolt, is that I don't want to be a downer. I don't want to, you know, make pro-lifers feel depressed or anything, but this is not going to have a sweeping change the way some people seem to be thinking. The one is that obviously the blue states won't be restricting abortion at all. It'll be very difficult to regulate or eliminate the distribution of abortion pills. You may see abortion clinics being established at state lines. And between all of those factors, you're probably going to see the number of abortions go down, but we had about 628,000 in the country before the pandemic. I think it's safe to say the pandemic may have disrupted the normal pattern of things, but people started using telemedicine for medical consultations on abortions and things like that. You know, one study put it about 100,000 fewer abortions will occur under this ruling. If you're a pro-lifer, that's good news, but that's not certainly not the end of it. And I think that what may strike people is that 6 months from now, a year from now, many Americans, it may not feel all that different because they live in jurisdictions where nothing changed.
So, Charlie, what do you make of the polling? It's my guess, and this is probably conventional wisdom on the right, that one, people didn't really understand what Roe was and still don't understand what it was. So they'll kind of be shocked to wake up a month from now and they're in Los Angeles or wherever it is and absolutely nothing has changed. And two, whatever effect from this will kind of wash out over time, and the issues that have been most dominant over the last year or two will rise to the top again. Maybe they're still at the top in terms of what people actually care about. So yes, this kind of upset the atmosphere around the midterms, but relative to all the other stuff, it'll be kind of a blip. I've also been sort of shocked at the leak did clearly bleach some of the energy around the reaction to this, because you can already feel kind of the news cycle moving on.
I think that there will be a marginal benefit to the Democrats, but I think it will be marginal for a couple of reasons. First off, the majority of the energy generated by the overturning of Roe is going to hit the states by design, because people will recognize what has and hasn't changed in their lives. Once they learn that Dobbs returned power to the legislature and the governor, they will inquire as to what that means for them, and in most places discover that the laws either haven't changed or are palatable. Obviously, in New York and California, there will be no change. In Florida, the change will be a 15-week regime, which is about where the state is. So the number of people who will be angry at the court for having permitted their state legislatures to change the law will be somewhat limited. That means that the cadre of voters who are likely to change their behavior because of this will be limited, in my estimation, to three groups. The first group is people who see real substantive dramatic changes at the state level and dislike them. For example, an independent voter who lives in Wyoming, who it seems in a month's time will be living under a full ban. The second group is people who haven't experienced any change themselves, but who are so angry on behalf of other people that they feel motivated to go out and vote for the Democrats or against the Republicans. I don't think there are too many of those people, but they do exist. You see them, for example, in the pro-Second Amendment community, where people who live in Texas and have every gun right they could possibly want still feel obliged to vote Republican because Democrats in other places have limited gun rights. And then the third group of people, and this is an even smaller group, but it does exist, are people who either are angry per se that the court overturned Roe, or who are worried that in having overturned Roe, to signal that it will make changes in other areas. But I think when you look at those three groups, and then you account for the fact that even now, abortion doesn't seem to rank especially highly on the intensity scale for most voters, the effect is going to be marginal overall.
So, Jim, this obviously has increased the attacks on the legitimacy of the courts. We've heard more about court packing and other quote unquote reforms. And one way this decision is supposedly illegitimate is that the justices lied in their confirmation hearings. This is gospel now on much of the left. Nancy Pelosi has said it. AOC has said basically we need impeachment hearings to begin for these justices. And a lot of this is just selective editing. You know, Amy Coney Barrett was discussing a super president, and that clip has been used to suggest she was saying that Roe was a super precedent that should never be touched. And then she's pressed by, I think it was Amy Klobuchar on this, and she's like, no, of course, Roe is not a super precedent. I'm taking lots of questions about Roe. It's obviously still up in the air. Brett Kavanaugh been a major focus because Susan Collins has come out and said that she was misled by Kavanaugh in a private meeting, which I find very hard to believe, because there's just no way, one, that I think Collins would have put the question directly to him, are you going to preserve, uphold Roe no matter what? I mean, she's been public that she thinks that would be inappropriate. And there's no way that Kavanaugh, you know, a shrewd and intelligent man, was going to answer that question if it was put to him directly. So it's very likely he was saying the same things in private as he was in public. Now, in public, he was, you know, he was putting an emphasis on the fact that Roe was a precedent that was upheld, not really, you know, semi-overturned is another way to look at it, by Casey. So he repeatedly used in the hearings the phrase precedent on precedent. Casey was a precedent on precedent, but he never said that means it can't be overturned. And in fact, Collins, in her floor statement supporting Kavanaugh, very dramatic, we're all waiting with bated breath on that one, said, you know, he says he'll give precedent, you know, all due considerations, very important force for stability in the law. But if a decision is egregiously wrong, then in rare circumstances, you can overturn it. And here we are. Roe was egregiously wrong.
Yeah. So, Rich, I am old enough to vaguely remember the confirmation hearings for Justice David Souter, nominated by George H.W. Bush. And when I say I remember the Jay Leno monologue jokes about it. I remember him saying, man, they can't, you know, pin down Souter on anything. The other day, they asked at the supermarket, they asked him paper or plastic, and he said he would just cite precedent. That was so the idea was everybody with any functioning brain cells knew what was going on in these sorts of confirmation hearings, that whenever a senator would ask about some particular issue, the justice was trying to chort, oh, senator, I could not possibly prejudge any issue or case that could end up before me in the court. But rest assured, I will respect precedent and I will read the Constitution. And, you know, this idea of punting every decision and not saying, because, you know, the irony is that, you know, almost every Democratic nominee to the Supreme Court, you know darn well how they're going to rule on every issue that comes down the pike. Otherwise, they wouldn't be the nominee. Whereas with Republican nominees, it was always a big gamble. And Souter was probably the biggest example of that. You could be a Republican nominee, and they sometimes would look for judges who, quote unquote, didn't have an extensive paper trail of lots of decisions on controversial issues to give you an indication of how they interpreted the Constitution, how they saw these issues. And, you know, I think the Souter was probably the biggest and most egregious example, but some would say Kennedy, some would say Sandra Day O'Connor, other justices nominated by Republican candidates who had, one, not necessarily ruled on the way conservatives had hoped to see on the Casey issue back in 1992, I think it was. And then just generally, you know, either drifting left or not being the originalist, strict constructionist, good judge, however you want to, whatever term you prefer to describe the kinds of justices conservatives prefer. So it turned into this little dance. It turned into this signal in which none of them were ever going to say, oh, yes, I'm going to rule this way if this issue comes before me. But you could look at their past decisions. You could look at their overall judicial philosophy. And you could have a pretty good sense of how they were going to do, although you certainly hope they didn't get any strange new respect and they didn't suddenly find themselves drifting leftward on this. So far, no one has proven any of this. Oh, by the way, a conversation with the senator is not under oath or something like that. If Susan Collins had suspicions about these justices, you know, ruling a certain way, she shouldn't have voted for them. And if you do have, if you don't have suspicions, you know, you should be like, again, if you really thought they were going to be, you know, preserve Roe, do you really think Donald Trump would have nominated them? Do you really think Donald Trump would have put them on that list that was specifically designed to reassure pro-lifers that if he became president, you'd get the kind of justices who would make a ruling like this? I think everyone is pretending to be surprised. I think everyone is pretending to be outraged. And I think this is all a very predictable result of how the dynamics of these Supreme Court fights have evolved over the past couple of decades.
Yeah, I mean, you're so right. Just if any judge considers himself or herself originalist, no matter how vague they are about their views on Roe, you know that judge very, very, very likely thinks that Roe is a travesty and bad law. I mean, there's no mystery here. I wish, we've talked about this a little bit on the podcast before, that nominees were more forthcoming at their hearings. You know, we know now in great detail what Clarence Thomas's views on substantive due process are. That doesn't make him, a judge who is not objective. He has a clear view of the Constitution. I think the kind of thing you would want to avoid that would really tarnish someone's objectivity, is that if they're close to the oil industry, or something like that. But a Supreme Court justice having a very clear take on the Constitution is not, there's nothing wrong with that. That's what you want. That's part of the job. But speaking of Clarence Thomas, Charlie, people, not that this is anything new, but folks have been coming after him hammer and tongs.
It's interesting that Clarence Thomas seems to be being blamed and mentioned far more than Alito, who wrote the opinion. I suppose this is for a couple of comprehensible reasons. The first is that Thomas penned the majority opinion in Bruin a day before Dobbs was decided. The second is that Thomas's concurrence contained a full-throated attack on the entire concept of substantive due process with a list of cases that he would like to revisit. Now, it's worth saying this was done because Alito in his majority opinion and Kavanaugh in his concurrence explicitly distinguished between Roe and, say, Obergefell or Lawrence. But Thomas is, unfortunately, from my perspective, out on a limb on this. And the attention that it's generated, I think, is mostly illiterate and certainly outsized. I think Clarence Thomas is one of the least well understood major figures in recent American history. In his autobiography, he acknowledges this at the beginning, and he says that he hopes that this book will do something to remedy that. Well, the book was published 15 years ago. It hasn't. Perhaps it will take a little more time.
Great book. Clarence,
it is a great book. But Clarence Thomas has an advantage, in fact, over some of the other judges at all levels, and an advantage over some of the other justices in that he is entirely comprehensible. His position is clear, and it is expressed without compunction or euphemism. Thomas will say out loud what he believes. He did so in Dobbs. He did so in Bruin. He does so when he's irritated that the court hasn't taken a case. He will criticize the court and telegraph where he would come out if the issue were considered on the merits. There's nothing about Thomas that is sinister or hidden or manipulative. His work stands for itself. He's forthright in his opinions. He feels no need to hide his approach. And it's notable, I think, that the one video that has been going around the internet in the last few days is of him saying at his book launch in 2007 that north is north, whether you're in the middle of a hurricane or on a sunny day, whether people are shouting at you or they're happy with you. That's his approach. And I think more than anything, that's what drives people crazy. I don't think that this is primarily about his being black. I don't think that this is primarily about Ginny Thomas, which is a more recent criticism. I think people find it alarming that he has such a firm and unapologetic approach to the law. But from my perspective, I wish we had nine of him.
He's one of our greatest contemporary Americans, there's just no doubt. I remember, Charlie, I asked you, I forget exactly what the exit question was, but the American you admire most or something a couple years ago, and you said Clarence Thomas, and it's just so, So spot on. And on top of everything else, just a wonderful man.
It's partly that, and it's partly his jurisprudence, but it's also what he represents because, you know, I'm 37 and I wasn't born in America. And the combination of those two things puts me at a real distance from, say, segregation, Jim Crow, and slavery. To the point at which I have to stop myself from conceiving of those things as ancient history, as as equivalent in the American tapestry as the Revolution or the settlers at Jamestown. But when you read Clarence Thomas's book, you realize, well, goodness me, when my father, who was born in 1947, was 10 years old, Clarence Thomas lived in segregated Georgia with separate water fountains and schools and parts of town you couldn't go to without being killed. That was his upbringing. His own grandfather was raised by a freed slave. And I think what Thomas represents, irrespective of his personal qualities or what you think of his jurisprudence, is American redemption. That somebody who was born into those circumstances can also exist, and happily, he wasn't always happy, especially when he was a black nationalist, as he'll say, but who can exist happily and contentedly and gratefully in the same world that I do. To me, that's a remarkable bridge, and it represents a continuity and a reflection of the virtue within the American experiment that we should appreciate.
So Jim Garrity, I asked a question to you, and I got to put extreme hypothetical alert on this exit question, but it has to do with how much political downside you'd be willing to accept to have gotten what we got here with the overturning of Roe. Would you take the overturning of Roe if the trade was that Republicans would not take back Congress for another 10 years, yes or no?
That is tough. And it's partially tough because I don't think those dynamics are in place in American politics anymore. You notice we've seen control of Congress switch every 6 to 8 years. I guess Republicans had the House for a long stretch during the, you know, 2010 to 2018. Even that was only 8 years. It's kind of hard to see one party keeping control of complete both houses for a whole decade.
Extreme hypothetical. I'm pushing you to the limits. How much political price or downside would you be willing to accept?
I mean, considering how I laid out how actually you may not see that many abortions reduced by this, I'm not sure it would be worth it. Every other priority you could do. And also noting that the abortion rate was going down bit by bit, year by year before then.
Charlie Cook.
I think it would be worth it because it righted a wrong within our constitutional order that transcends the underlying political issue. The whole purpose of originalism is to separate out the law from the politics. As such, I find myself hoping to see cases overturned whose outcomes I liked. Obergefell, Lawrence, Griswold. But this, as Scalia pointed out so eloquently in his Casey dissent, went far beyond the proximate cause of the case, which was abortion law, and had placed the Supreme Court into a position, not just judicially, but politically, that damaged the institutions that Americans need for self-government. We started this podcast with you asking about Senate confirmation hearings and how they are conducted. And that is, and has been since 1987, really, when this kicked into high gear, almost exclusively the product of Roe and then Casey. And to take that out of our political order and to right that egregious wrong legally and constitutionally, I think, yes, would be worth a great deal.
I'm with you. I think you just have to do it on principle, no matter what, that the Constitution and honoring it has to be our highest priority. And this was a complete blight and distortion of the Constitution. So I view it a little bit like Brexit. You know, it's easy for me to say in the case of Brexit because I'm not over in the UK, but if it costs you a recession, you take it. You know, it's a historic achievement. And getting off on a major, getting out of a major rabbit hole that is taking your country down the wrong path. Where I tend to agree with Jim is when it comes to restrictions on abortion, then I think, you know, you have to pay more attention to the politics, because you could really set your cause back if you go too far or you're totally heedless of where public opinion is and the need for public persuasion. But if that were to trade overturning Roe in exchange for not taking back Congress for a decade, I would take it. So with that, let's hear from our first sponsor this episode, NetChoice. For Americans, innovation has always been what makes us different. We have the most innovative industries that power the American way of life. Free markets and innovation are what make us number one. But some in Washington want to put big government in charge of America's top innovators, attacking our own in the name of competition, while true competitors like Europe and China close the gap. Conservatives can't allow progressives to hand over even more power to our oversized federal bureaucracy and cause more inflation with more regulation. Congressional conservatives must stand against big government by rejecting progressive antitrust proposals. Join us in telling our representatives to oppose Senator Klobuchar's radical antitrust bill, S-2992. Learn more about this fight and send a letter to your representatives at netchoice.org/2992. That's netchoice.org/2992. This message brought to you, of course, by NetChoice. So, Charlie, speaking of the court, we have another consequential decision having to do with this football coach who insisted on praying after games. The basic trajectory here was that this was at the outset a more kind of a public event. You know, he was joined by a bunch of people. The school complained, told him he couldn't do it. So it was generally over time steadily whittled down to him basically praying on his own. And he still couldn't even do that. And this has been a case that's been going on. He sued when he was blocked and I guess was fired. And he's been pursuing this for years. And finally, the court said, yeah, he can do that. It's a matter of free expression and it's not an establishment of a state religion. What do you make of it?
Well, I think that's the key. It was not the establishment of a state religion. I should probably back up a little bit here and say that I think that the vast majority of the Supreme Court's 20th century jurisprudence on this question is wrong. In fact, I'm not convinced that the establishment clause within the First Amendment can be meaningfully incorporated to the states because it has an intrinsically federal nature. But even if we disagree on that and suppose that one could incorporate the Establishment Clause with the rest of the First Amendment via the Privileges and Immunities Clause, or as it has been via the Substantive Due Process Doctrine, it seems a massive stretch to me to argue that the public display of religious affiliation outside of a classroom is akin to the state establishment of a religion. I don't think that's correct. The Lemon case from 1971 that this latest case explicitly overruled was wrong. It was unworkable. It was tendentious. The argument here seems to be that if anyone who is a role model or who is in a position of authority expresses a religious view within a school environment or any circumstance in which people are obliged to attend, that they are indirectly coercing free people into their religious order. I don't think it holds up. Even when that case is put well, as it has been, it's not put well in the dissent, it doesn't convince me. I don't think that is the original public meaning of the Establishment Clause. I don't think that's the original public meaning of an incorporated establishment clause as understood by the framers of the 14th Amendment. I think that this is bad law. I think it's bad precedent. And I think that as the majority did, although more narrowly than I would have, the free exercise clause should have precedence here. It would be a much trickier case if we were talking about a school curriculum, if we were talking about classes. Although, you know, I've heard some Christians and Muslims point out that they often feel indirectly coerced in public schools away from their faith. So that's an interesting area too.
Yeah, I was always wondering these sort of cases, Charlie. So what religion is this guy establishing? Where's the church meet? You know, is it just meets on the 50-yard line on Friday nights? It's just...
Yeah. So I think that the core problem here is that for quite a long time, the Supreme Court of the United States has come to regard the First Amendment as if it contained, protected, demanded a French conception of religious mm-hmm. freedom rather than an American one. In France, there is and has been for quite a while this concept called laïcité. And that wishes to discourage or in some cases rid from the public square religious observance. And that's why France has certain bans on headscarves. It's also why you will not see any religious iconography within public settings. But that's not how America was set up. Now, I understand there are people who would like America to have been set up that way, but that's not how America was set up. America was set up to protect religious exercise and primarily to protect religious people and their institutions from the government, not the other way around. And I just cannot find support in the text, in the structure, or the history of our constitutional order for interpreting the Establishment Clause as a constricting mechanism mm-hmm. on yeah. people who are not directly exercising their power on behalf of the government, which sometimes teachers are, but here the teacher was not.
So, Jim, I imagine your attitude would be, if this was a coach for the Jets, it would be, pray harder, my friend. You got to pray harder.
You know, back when I was growing up, there was a joke about what do John Paul II and Boomer Esiason have in common? They can both get 70,000 people into Giant Stadium yelling, Jesus Christ! Now, look, I certainly can't lay this out as eloquently and thoroughly and insightfully as Charlie did. So I'm just going to try to simplify this as much as possible. Rich, when someone sneezes around Justice Sonia Sotomayor, what does she say?
Gesundheit.
I was going to say, she's going to cite something foreign. Because if she says, God bless you, if she calls upon God to bless the person who sneezed, wouldn't that be a similar establishment of a state religion? Actually, I'm presuming based on this, what we saw earlier this year, I'm assuming Justice Sotomayor would say, I hope you're wearing a mask. Remember, there are 10,000 kids on ventilators right now because of COVID-19.
I have to say about Sonia Sotomayor, I'm sure you saw this, Jim, the segment that was going around, a video clip of her 2 or 3 weeks ago. She was talking to a bunch of kids, and she was talking how wonderful Clarence Thomas is. And actually, that was a real nice moment. You know, I don't have a lot of regard for Sonia Sotomayor as a jurist. I think she's basically a joke as a jurist, but she recognizes what a wonderful man Clarence Thomas is. And she was willing to say it to those kids and kind of give them a sense that, you know, you can disagree, but still do it agreeably. But anyway, just an aside.
No, Rich, I completely concur. It was a really special, sweet moment. And as far as I'm concerned, it almost makes up for her leaking the Alito draft. Oh, okay. I guess it could be anybody. But, boy, it's been 2 months and they haven't named anybody, huh? I wonder what's going on there. So yeah, just kind of observing this. Also, I spent a good portion of yesterday saying that Sonia Sotomayor wanted to rename at the end of the game when you're throwing a deep pass and just hoping your receiver catches it. Because we certainly don't want to call that a Hail Mary pass anymore. That would be... You
know. Jim, it is worth saying here that I know you're joking about the potential consequences of the dissenter's opinion having prevailed. But Gorsuch says in his majority opinion that under the standard that the dissenters lay out, a teacher wearing a yarmulke could be held to be in violation of the Constitution. And the dissent doesn't address or rebut that.
I think the entire issue boils, can almost be boiled down to one word of coercion, right? You don't want a state religion because you don't want government coercing people into a religious belief that they do not authentically have. You do not want to force people into matters of some sort of conscience like that. And if anybody had proved that the kids were being coerced into participating in this prayer, I think everyone would feel very differently about it. There was no evidence of that. And the answer from the minority was that, well, just because it's conceivable, because there could be, because teachers are inherently coercive in their position of authority, that the state had to coerce those teachers and coaches into not expressing their religious faith in this particular circumstance. You replace one threat of coercion with another. Oh, by the way, if teachers are inherently coercive by discussing such matters, do we want to apply that to their discussions of sexual orientation, transgender mm-hmm. issues?
Yeah.
That's not religious, so that doesn't count. Okay, just wanted to check on that. Yeah.
So that is a good segue to the next question to you, Charlie. Our post-liberal friends say that liberalism, the Constitution and all this is a mug's game. It really harms people of faith. But contrary to that, actually, the Constitution and Supreme Court and conservatism tethered to the Constitution is the best friend that people of faith have in this current moment in the United States of America. Yes or no?
Yes, I think our post-liberal friends have embarrassed themselves, and they ought to feel ashamed because they were wrong. Their predictions about originalism and its consequences were wrong. Their criticisms of the Federalist Society were wrong. Their criticisms of National Review were wrong. What they have long failed to grasp is that the provisions that they so disdain could have been written to protect them as dissenters, and that while they might not extend that courtesy to us, we and the institutions and ideas that we prefer are quite happy to extend it to them.
Jim Garrity.
Rich, I look forward to the new complaint. Okay, other than ending Roe versus Wade, what have conservatives ever done?
So, as you pointed out, Jim, when you're citing, you know, the gender stuff and LGB stuff, I mean, there's an effort to impose a kind of religion or at least a sort of morality on the United States and on our kids. And the First Amendment is going to be a way in the Constitution to protect ourselves from such coercion. So anyone who has dreams of having sort of a Catholic inflected kind of soft theocracy in America is totally out to lunch. If these protections were removed, the theocracy would not be one of our making. It'd be one of run by the atheists and the hardcore woke. So with that, let me do a brief plug for the National Review cruise that's coming up here in the fall. We had an interruption of the cruises with the pandemic, but this is a 20-year tradition we've had at National Review. The National Review Institute is now taking on the cruises, and the ship will be setting sail for 7 days in the Caribbean. And you'll be able to enjoy fine dining, entertainment, world-class accommodations as you rub elbows with NR personalities and other special guests during panel discussions, breakout sessions, and exclusive 1955 Society events. So you can join us in November, and destinations include the Bahamas, Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, and more. So to register, go to nricruise.com, nricruise.com. I can assure you these are wonderful events. We have people who've been, you know, almost going on every single cruise for 20 years, because once you go on one, you tend to be hooked. Great fellowship, great content, great conversation, great cigars, great cocktails. You will have a wonderful time. So if you've come before, please join us again. If you haven't, we'd love to make your acquaintance on the big boat. So, Jim Garrity, we got rumors. Who knows what's going to happen? But we got rumors that Donald Trump is going to announce early, by which I mean imminently, you know, maybe on July 4th. For me, this would kind of be a sign of weakness. It would be a sign that he's really afraid of the kind of momentum that Ron DeSantis has been building. DeSantis, I mean, just talk to conservatives. There's much more chatter about DeSantis these days than there is about Trump. You tend to hear from a lot of people, oh, you know, I like Trump. I appreciate what he did. You know, he's been treated unfairly, but geez, I hope he doesn't run again. And to a man and a woman, people who feel that way, the next name on their lips is Ron DeSantis. So I think going early would be a sign that the Trump is aware of this and he's hoping to try to cut off DeSantis at the pass.
Rich, I'm going to step back into a little bit of really obscure National Review history. Late 2006, I had written the Kerry spot in the 2004 cycle going over to Turkey. And your distinguished colleague, Catherine Lopez, talked to me as I was shortly before I was about to return back from Turkey to come back and write what was going to be called the Hillary spot, because clearly Hillary Clinton was going to be the nominee in 2008. Life has some interesting curveballs for that one. We eventually changed it to the campaign spot because I suspect National Review readers really just didn't want to click on anything that had the word Hillary in it. And I decided we would start it in January 2007. And I chuckled because, like, okay, nothing's going to be happening that early. This is going to be an extremely low, slow-paced sort of thing. I wasn't scheduled to come back until about mid-March 2007. But, okay, you know, really, things don't pick up. It's wildly, absurdly early to begin a presidential campaign coverage. Well, not only did Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and a whole bunch of other Democrats announce within the first couple of days of 2007, I believe it was Tom Vilsack, the then governor of Iowa, and then who went on to become the agriculture secretary. And I think he's still the agriculture secretary, once and future agriculture secretary, entered the presidential campaign and ended his presidential campaign before I came back from Turkey in March 2007. So we already have this very bad trend of presidential campaigns beginning absurdly early, right? January, right after the midterm elections, is a ludicrously long time. Because when you know, people say, oh, running for president costs so much. Well, part of the reason it costs so much is because you start so early and you got to go hire those staff. You got to go around and start doing all this stuff. And never mind the fact that half these presidential campaigns basically are book tours, staying at Holiday Inns, but, you know, with more time in New Hampshire and Iowa. So this is all separate from the decision of, you know, should Trump run again and all that stuff. But the idea of announcing you're running for president on or around July 4th, 2.5 years before the election, is utterly absurd. And also, by the way, I think it's, you know, a terrible idea for Republican prospects in the 2022 midterms. Not part of this is because of the controversy of Donald Trump. Part of this is because it's been good for Republicans to develop an identity separate from Donald Trump. I think Youngkin is probably the best example of this. But if you are running for any, you notice Mehmet Oz basically distanced himself from Trump the moment the primary was over. Donald Trump is not popular in a whole bunch of the places where Republicans have hopes of winning this year. Just the other day, and I read about this in today's Morning Jolt, this spectacularly bizarre and wonderful result. Right now, a Republican is leading in the House race in Rhode Island's 2nd congressional district. Rhode Island has not sent a Republican to Congress, to the House of Representatives, since 1992. Right, we have the ingredients there for a fantastic year. But if you turn this into a nationalized election of what do you think about Trump, that could, I think it'll mitigate Republican gains. I don't think it'll destroy him. But boy, oh boy, I think this does put Trump on the, you know, effectively on the ballot. And if Republicans don't do as well as we think they're going to do right now, with gas being $6 or $7 across the country and runaway inflation and your grocery bill makes you gasp every time you look at it and stuff like that. If Republicans don't gain with all these factors, because Donald Trump has decided to make himself the centerpiece of the election, the election again, I do think it's one more piece of evidence they should not renominate him in 2024. And finally, I've heard this anecdotally from other folks or read about this from other folks in Trump world. I don't pretend to have absolute clarity about what's going on in Trump's mind. They're going to observe, like, no one says he yearns to be president. He's not yearning to have all those cabinet meetings. He's not thinking, oh man, I really loved the foreign travel and meeting with foreign leaders and all that stuff. people say Trump is bored. People say Trump misses running for president. I don't think he necessarily misses being president. And here's the thing. If you don't want to actually do the job, you should not run for the job. So this is potentially catastrophic. I think it'll be dead weight for a lot of Republicans in a lot of places where Trump is not popular. I'm hoping this is not the case, but people who seem better connected and more informed than me do make it sound like this is pretty imminent.
Yeah. So maybe it isn't the case. I agree with you. It would be a drag on Republican candidates. I'm not sure how much of a drag, but Troy, I kind of think I posted about this over the weekend that it could help some of the alternative Republican candidates in 2024. I think, you know, the ones who've just said they're not going to run because if Trump gets in, will just be, they'll have to say they're out. But if you're a DeSantis, the big risk is what if you get into the race and then Trump comes in after you and, you know, his strength, he seems fairly strong now, Trump, but his strength has been hidden by the fact that he wasn't an announced candidate. He announces, he trounces you, he gives you a nickname, he stomps all over you. If Trump gets in now and DeSantis is still tied with him, say, in New Hampshire, there was a very encouraging poll last week that had DeSantis 39 to 37 over Trump in New Hampshire. Small sample size, obviously extremely early, but if that's basically still the situation, that's a flashing green light and permission to get in and a sign that the water is okay. And Trump may be doing DeSantis and others the favor of broadcasting what is not overwhelming strength as an actual declared candidate.
I agree. My reaction to the news that he might jump in is, or would be best expressed by one of Michael Brendan Doughty's sighs, both because I do not want Trump to be in our politics anymore, and because I think it will hurt Republicans in the midterms. In the longer term, though, I think that getting in too early could hurt him, as you suggest. I wonder if he gets in and people say, and start to look around for another option.
Mm-hmm.
His timing might be ill. He might be better off waiting until the decision point, the moment at which one has to really get in or not, because he will have an advantage over the DeSantises of the world in that he will have pop-up infrastructure, having been president before. But if you do it now, well, then you're giving people notice, you're giving them time to plan, you're giving them time to establish how they will fight you. You know, that's the other thing. Why is it that in any war, the invading force tries to obfuscate where they'll be attacking? If you look back to D-Day or the Italy campaign before it, the aim of the Allies was to leave the Germans wondering if it would be here or there, because then you have to draw up two plans. As the attacking force, you have one, but as the defending force, you need to have two, and maybe you split your resources as well. Well, at the moment, if he is thinking of running for president, a Ron DeSantis has to have two plans. He has to have the plan if Trump runs, and then the plan if Trump doesn't run. Trump gets in tomorrow, that narrows down to one. Suddenly you know what you're working on, what talking points you need to think up, what areas you need to emphasize, where you need to spend your money, which voters you're trying to take away from him, and so on and so forth. So I'm not convinced that an early announcement would do what Trump hopes it will do. And as Jim says, there's also the potential downside that it limits Republican gains in November and then confirms in the minds of many Republicans that Trump is a drag rather than a boost.
It also, yeah, it would just be an incredibly selfish act yet again. And you got to think eventually, maybe the selfishness will tell against them. I was having one of these many conversations with a friend I've had the last year and a half, but Georgia, what he did in Georgia with those Senate specials would have killed anyone else. It would have killed anyone else, but he just gets away with it. And this would be selfish in two ways. One, the potential downside in the midterms. Two, he'd be doing it also to check the rise of an incredibly talented younger politician, you know, who agrees with him on a lot of stuff by the name of Ron DeSantis. So, Jim Garrity, open-ended exit question to you. You are invited to a one-on-one lunch with Donald Trump, and you are sitting across the table with him, burgers on your plates or well-done steaks on your plates. And your job is to convince him not to run in 2024. What do you say in a couple sentences?
Right now, you are the president who ended Roe versus Wade, and many Republicans have extraordinarily fond memories of your presidency, at least before COVID-19. If you run again and lose, you're a two-time loser, and that will be the first line in your obituary.
Charlie Cook.
I would say, Donald Trump, I'm not calling him Mr. President, he's not the president. Donald Trump, if you run for president in 2024, you will make Rich Lowry, Jonah Goldberg, and Peggy Noonan really happy. To avoid them ever being happy again, announce that you're not running. No, I think I would say, and of course I would have zero sway with him, at least if he knows who I am, but I would say there are millions of people out there who are extremely grateful for what you did when you ran, particularly on the Supreme Court. And you can only go down in their estimations. I think that has the benefit both of being true and appealing to Trump's sense of vanity. Presumably, he does not want to end up losing a primary. And unless he plans some elaborate two-year lie about having really won the primaries and being cheated out of it by I don't know who, then there is a risk to him here that he's a two-time loser.
Yeah, so Charlie made a reference to this statement that Trump put out, I guess it was Sunday morning, denouncing mostly it was occasioned by Peggy Noonan, but including some others, including me in there for destroying National Review's supposedly. And I have to say, just another little straw in the wind, I heard a little bit about it. But the first I knew about it was sometime Sunday afternoon. I finally noticed a text from someone. It just did not have the impact that it would have any time the last 5 years. And you know, I've been at the receiving end of some Trump blasts, especially in 15 and 16, and then some praise here or there in the ensuing 4 years. And your phone would blow up. It was just a huge event. And this just wasn't. So I think it's really hard to convince them not to do it. I basically agree with the Jim and Charlie approaches. Maybe all three of us should go together, guys, as a delegation. But I would say, yeah, you did incredible things. Everyone's going to be so grateful to you. And you don't want to mess it up by losing a second time. And two, even if you win, it'll be a miserable experience. They will be dogging you every step of the way. It'll make the Russia hoax look like child's play. And it's not just you. You've already seen, you know, the first time around, it's going to be true to a greater extent. The second time around, it's going to involve your family. For the good of them and your historic reputation, historical reputation, just don't do it. Play golf, be a kingmaker, take credit for anything good that happens. So with that, let's hit a few other things before we go. Jim Garrity, you had a trip to Annapolis.
Yeah, we spent Father's Day this year driving back from Hilton Head, so it really wasn't much of a special day. So my family was kind enough to say, okay, we'll do this the following Sunday. We could do anything I wanted. And I said, okay, you know, Annapolis is about an hour away. Annapolis is just extraordinarily underrated as this charming, historic city, beautiful waterfront. You know, for relatively cheap, you can get these nice little, water taxis or water tour boats. It'll take you around the Naval Academy. My family loved there's an ice cream shop in there that's fantastic. And it was just a good food, great place. weather wasn't too bad. And just, you know, so if you're in the DC area looking to get away, you really can't beat a day at Annapolis.
Charlie, you had an epic roller coaster ride.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can absolutely beat a day in Annapolis. I was driving back from an event I attended in South Florida on the West Coast. And I came pretty close to Busch Gardens, Tampa, and thought, you know what? I'm going to go in, break up the drive. So I did. And they have a brand new roller coaster there called Iron Gwazi. It's a hybrid coaster, the biggest in the Southeast, built by RMC. And it was absolutely magnificent. Shot all the way up to the top of my rankings, maybe tied at the top. But if you are in Florida around that area, or if you're not, I would recommend visiting Busch Gardens Tampa and riding Iron Gwazi.
So I hate to brag, but I got to brag about my Coke discernment. I was in a restaurant yesterday, ordered a Coke. The Coke came out and it had that telltale motor oil type taste. And the waiter came back and I was like, I'm sorry, this there's something wrong with this. This isn't a Coke. This isn't a regular Coke. And he's like, no, you know, I got it myself from the fountain. It was a regular Coke. And I was like, I'm telling you, this is not regular Coke. So he goes, leaves for a while and then comes back. And it turns out there was a terrible mistake where a canister of Diet Coke was hooked up to the regular Coke dispenser. So it was indeed not regular Coke. And the waiter was duly impressed. And then they undertook major exertions to right this wrong that was being done to every person in that restaurant ordering a regular Coke. So with that, it's time for our editor's picks. Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
Well, I'm going to go with Alexander DeSantis's Harris abortion lets dads off the hook, spotlighting one of the more egregious comments from Kamala Harris lately. And let's face it, there's a lot of competition for that title. But more importantly, you may have noticed that Alexander is not with us today. She is out somewhere on promoting her new book, Tearing Us Apart, co-written with Ryan T. Anderson, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solves Nothing. I urge all listeners to go out there, go to your Amazon.com, go to Barnes & Noble, go to your bookstores, get that book. If they don't have it, ask the bookstore to purchase it, to order it for you.
You're here.
And if they won't do it, don't patronize that place again, you know. Yes. So, you know, I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but you've listened to Alexandra of this program. You know, this is going to be a first-rate work. Go check it out.
And great timing for her book. Charlie Cook, what's your pick?
I honestly can't believe, Jim, that Kamala Harris said that.
I think
as
about
a father
men,
of yeah. two sons. So exactly the person she was talking to or trying to talk to. I watched the clip and I thought, when is she going to say something that couldn't also have been said by Dave Portnoy? And then she didn't. The implication was just grotesque.
She is the worst.
This is her idea of what's going to appeal to fathers of sons. Yeah.
My editor's pick is by Kyle Smith. It's a treatise on Beavis and Butthead and its broader meaning within our culture, its message. I say this all the time, but this could only have been written by Kyle.
So my pick is an MBD piece, Rose End Took Everybody, a judicious MBD piece, just making the case that this was an all-around effort. And then there's been this big debate about, you know, is this Trump's victory? Is it not Trump's victory? And MBD makes the point. It's just what a movement does. It makes it's bigger than any one person. And it kind of bends everyone its way. And this happened with Donald Trump. But there's no doubt, you know, Trump, once he was nominated, he needed to win in 16. And then he needed to follow through on these picks. And he did with three of them. So I don't think that's an achievement that can't be taken away from him. But the larger point is this is an achievement of millions of people and a movement. And it's just it was a wonderful day, just a wonderful day Friday. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Jim. Thanks to NetChoice. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.